Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Amanpour. Here's what's coming up.
Trump's top team in Turkey to rein in Erdogan's Syria offensive. One clear winner out of this chaos, Russia. We talk to the former Russian Prime Minister Mikhail Kasyanov. Then
we have a deal.
Another Prime Minister, another Brexit deal. But can this one pass Parliament? I talk to Tony Blair's former Chief of Staff, Jonathan Powell. And
people were inciting violence against me. People would give me death threats. Some would give me rape threats.
A human rights activist since she was 16. Pakistan's Gulala Ismail talks to Michelle Martin about standing up against abuse and being forced into hiding.
Welcome to the program, everyone. I'm Christiane Amanpour in London. Top U.S. officials, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo and Vice President Mike Pence, have made a desperate attempt to get President Erdogan to stop his bloody offensive in Syria after President Trump essentially gave it the green light. American allies, the ISIS-fighting Syrian Kurds, are now holding mass funerals for their dead as they accuse the United States of abandoning them. A humanitarian disaster is underway amid calls for the UN to somehow stop this. It has transpired that after the backlash against his move, President Trump tried appealing to Erdogan himself through a letter that surfaced yesterday in which he said, "Don't be a tough guy. Don't be a fool." And back in Washington, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi revealed more details about this contentious meeting with President Trump.
I also pointed out to the president I had concerns that the L road seemed to lead to Putin. The Russians have been trying to get a foothold in the Middle East for a very long time, unsuccessfully, and now the president has given them an opportunity.
This is a mounting concern in the U.S. military and among U.S. allies. Mikhail Kasyanov served as Russia's prime minister during Vladimir Putin's first term, but now he's a vocal opponent of the Russian leader, and he's joining me now from London. Welcome back to our program.
Thank you very much.
So can I just ask you to comment on what House Speaker Nancy Pelosi said, that when it comes to President Trump and various issues, all roads seem to lead to Putin, and that this is exactly what Russia, Putin, has wanted for a long, long time. And after a long absence, Trump has given them an entree back into the Middle East. Do you agree with that formulation?
I think to a great extent, yes. Putin just the main beneficiary of what's going on there. He, for many years, said just Assad is legitimate president and we legally support, military support Assad there. And despite of the fact that there is an agreement between Iran, Turkey and Putin, right now, we see that the situation develops in a different way. Erdogan heading just into Syrian territory, creating a buffer zone, and we see Kurds left on the field in front of Turkish tanks. I cannot understand the reason why U.S. president made such a decision. Just to the most important, the most, I would say, the best allies in fighting ISIS now left alone without any support and protection.
What do you think President Putin thinks about that? Because obviously he also was part of, I mean, he said it from the United Nations. That's his sort of public stance anyway, that he too is in the fight against ISIS. Do you think he has any sympathy for the Syrian Kurds, or is he kind of okay with this development because now Russian forces have rushed up there?
Mr. Putin is okay only with one issue, how to keep personal power and to dismiss, by protests, different dictators like we had in just and before. Mm-hmm. Now, including Assad, for them, it's unacceptable at all. That's why he's fighting for his own future, not to have another example that a dictator could be dismissed by people's movement. Mm-hmm. With the support of different other allies.
Because he doesn't want that to happen to himself.
Absolutely. Same in Ukraine, same in other countries.
Mm-hmm. Let me just ask you again, though, because Russians seem to be... They're happy that their leadership, that their country is playing a major role. And actually, I don't know whether you agree, but sort of filling a vacuum that seems to have been left by the United States progressively, and now at its apogee with this issue. I mean, you have Putin obviously making hay out of what's going on in Syria. Putin was in Saudi Arabia not so long ago. You know, he's here, there and everywhere. He's got very close ties with the Prime Minister of Israel. Despite your differences and your political differences with Putin himself, as a Russian, do you think it's good for Russia to be able to fill this vacuum in the Middle East?
In fact, just Russian society is split approximately 50-50. 50% who in reality support Putin, they are ready to be in poor position and keep patience. And just this is post-empire, Soviet empire syndrome works well. But other 50%, mostly middle class, living in the big cities, of course, they're contrary, absolutely against these things. They would like to be a normal European state so that human rights would be protected and their rights to vote, to be elected and elect, would be implemented in practice. But Putin ignoring this. That's why he needs short victories, quick victories, to raise personal legitimacy outside Russia, because inside Russia he doesn't have enough of legitimacy.
That's interesting.
That's why short victorious war in Syria, that is source of propaganda. And now just this 50% applauding Mr. Putin that finally he got what he wanted. He bringing back, together with Erdogan and Iranian authority, bringing back almost the whole territory of Syria under Assad's control.
Which some people are just heartbroken by, because for the last many years, perhaps 5 to 7 years, in fact, that band up there in northern Syria was stabilized. There was peace up there, and the Kurds were fighting ISIS and all of that. And this has all gone up in smoke now. And Assad will, as you say, regain the majority of his territory.
And will start punishing those Kurds who was just playing games with Americans. And now just everything coming back, unfortunately. That's disaster.
So what do you think, then, when you see this picture in your mind? I mean, you've talked now just about, you know, probably another bloodbath. First the Turkish bloodbath, then the Assad bloodbath, although the Syrian Kurds have made a deal with Assad for the moment. And do you see ISIS rising again? Many people are very worried about ISIS rising because of all of this.
It could be, because just those Kurds, fighters, they will not undertake any further efforts on that. Mm-hmm. And they already mentioned this somewhere. There is an information somewhere I read on the internet. They said, just in this case, we will not continue the fighting. It means just reinauguration of ISIS potentially possible.
President Putin has either summoned or agreed to have a meeting with President Erdogan in Sochi next week. The presidential spokesman is saying that they're very, you know, upset at what the Russians are saying. They're upset at what Turkey is doing in northern Syria. What do you think is going to happen? And we know Mike Pompeo and Vice President Mike Pence are trying to get Erdogan to stop or slow down. I mean, from what you know about the region, can they have an effect on Erdogan? Can Putin have an effect on Erdogan?
I think there will be some kind of agreement, some kind of deal. And Erdogan would establish this buffer zone, mm-hmm. and will push those 3.5 million of refugees sitting on territory of Turkey and just providing with food and the medicine given on the money of European Union. But he pushed them on the territory of Syria. He said, you are Syrians, live there, and let's international community would provide appropriate support. Not Erdogan, but international community. And the whole devastated country back under Assad's control.
It is actually remarkable. Let me just move to domestic Russian politics and protests. You, as I said, were prime minister under Vladimir Putin. You then became a vocal opponent, and you've tried to run against him. We've seen unprecedented protests this summer in Russia. How do you analyze them? Are they what we see in the outside? Are they unprecedented? Are they meaningful? Do they have any hope of breaking through?
There's a new wave. It's new development in Russia. And I'm very happy that it's happening. New generation, for the first time, appeared on the streets because of a simple reason. They wanted to participate in the regional elections to Moscow Duma, Moscow Parliament of city of Moscow. Moscow is 10% of population. It is important part, important region, not just the city, important region of Russia. And these you guys wanted to nominate their candidates and wanted to vote for them, but they were cut on both.
Mm-hmm. We're seeing pictures of those
and that's
protests.
Why I just appeared on the streets, just to protect their constitutional rights, their freedom, which they thought it's untouchable. It's appeared to be doesn't exist.
But what do you think the unprecedented turnout of these young people is saying or being felt in the Kremlin?
They in Kremlin, people are shocked about that. They were not prepared for that. And that's why they decided to suppress all these demonstrations. And there was awful pictures how people were beaten without any reasoning. It's peaceful demonstration. I would say since when the first anti-Putin demonstration started in 2006 till now, there was no broken window, no broken car in the streets of Moscow. But these people are beaten by police in a heavy manner, and just some of them in a jail. And now, again, 14, 15 people already under criminal investigation, some of them already convicted and already in jail.
Alexei Navalny is one of the biggest names of the protest leaders in Russia today. And he has said that, you know, sure, they can put me into jail, but every time they do, another big protest happens. And this is just like a self, you know, like a constant vicious circle. Does Navalny have any hope of challenging Putin anytime soon? I mean, is any opposition going to be able to? The next elections are in 2021.
I tell you, just not a bright story, but I'll tell you that we, for many years, cannot be united. I mean, democratic opposition. That's major reason why people not so enthusiastic. Because they say, as soon as you united, we will support you wider. Navalny is one of the leaders, but he's the brightest leader on the street. But he's not a leader of all opposition. There should be combination of all political groups. In fact, we have four independent political groups. If we unite ourselves and start preparing now, then September 2021 could be a turning point. Because it's a constitutional event, elections to Federal Duma. And in this case, if we united and in the streets would be 100,000 people, 500,000 people, Mr. Putin will realize that relaxation should start. Otherwise, revolution would be inevitable.
Gosh, that's pretty dramatic. Let me now get back to Putin and the United States. Just last week or over the weekend, he made this comment about, again, he talked about trying to make better relations with the U.S., but always, he says, you know, events intervene.
Знаем, все знаем, что и как говорит президент Соединенных Штатов господин Трамп по поводу российско-американских отношений. Мы знаем, что и в ходе предвыборной кампании, еще предыдущей, он высказывался за нормализацию, но, к сожалению, до сих пор этого не сделано. Но мы не в претензии, потому что мы видим, что происходит во внутриполитической жизни Соединенных Штатов.
И okay. What do you think he means by that?
I think just Mr. Putin would like President Trump to make a gift to Mr. Putin. The gift means to start treating Russia as a special case, like in the past Soviet Union, or like China now. Maybe it's not a good example with respect to Trump and China, but something is different, not like a part of international agreements, like OECD agreement, when Mr. Putin destroyed the whole architecture of European security. Not like human rights convention, European Convention on Human Rights. Mr. Putin violates human rights every day. He wants a special permission, special ticket from Mr. Trump, and European Union too, just to behave and to interpret international law in a way Mr. Putin wants. Syria is one other example. Ukraine is another example.
Okay, I was going to ask you about Ukraine and the final question. Do you think, as many people have said, that this whole situation with President Trump and the, you know, conversation with President Zelensky and the supposed quid pro quo and the holding up of aid and all the rest of it is a gift to Mr. Putin? He's a winner out of all of this?
For me, it's the main concern is that Ukraine badly needs support, international support right now. This country just deserved to be supported to build up a democratic state. And they now have problems, not only Crimea, annexed by Mr. Putin, but also in east part of Ukraine. Mm-hmm. And they're asking the United States for military support. United States is responsible to provide support for Ukraine and to support territorial integrity and sovereignty of Ukraine as the Budapest Protocol of 1994. And that is a legitimate, I would say, approach to President Trump by President Zelensky. Help us to keep our sovereignty. And in return, some kind of, I would say, not decision-making process as usually United States just demonstrated. We don't understand, and people in Ukraine don't understand what's going on, why it's faced with such a problem.
Well, it is a huge problem, and it seems to have backfired for Mr. Zelensky. We'll see how it proceeds. Former Russian Prime Minister Mikhail Kasyanov, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. It was a great pleasure.
And now, the majority of Republicans in the House joined their Democratic counterparts to condemn President Trump's Syria moves last night. And today, a Trump ally, the U.S. ambassador to the EU, is testifying to the congressional impeachment inquiry about the president's moves in Ukraine. Political appointee Gordon Sondland says that Trump directed him to work through Rudy Giuliani, president's personal attorney, rather than government channels. Here's part of his opening statement. He says, "We were also disappointed by the president's direction that we involve Mr. Giuliani. Our view was that the men and women of the State Department, not the president's personal lawyer, should take responsibility for all aspects of U.S. foreign policy towards Ukraine." Now, Nina Jankovic is a Ukraine expert at the Wilson Center, and she's joining me from Washington. Welcome to the program, Nina Jankovic.
Thanks for having me, Christiane.
Can I just ask you perhaps to follow up a little from what the former Prime Minister Kasyanov has just said? That, look, here you have a new Ukrainian president. He desperately, obviously, he was, probably as a neophyte to politics in Ukraine as President Trump has been in the United States. But he wants help. He wants military aid. He's got the Russians still fighting in eastern Ukraine, still annexing Crimea. And he makes this sort of somehow appeal to President Trump. Has he just been, I don't know, is it his naivete that's tripped him up, or is there something else going on, do you think?
No, I don't think it's his naivete at all. I think President Zelensky had one choice. He had to go and represent Ukraine and the 70% of the Ukrainian population that voted him into office as best he could with President Trump in those phone calls he had in order to get that military aid and the other democratic support that the United States gives to Ukraine, over $500 million in 2017. And that was Zelensky's one chance, essentially, to appeal to Mr. Trump and say, help me end this war in Donbass, which was one of the main things that he was elected on.
So when you look at that transcript and the phone call and you hear what President Trump has said since, I mean, he said this was a perfect phone call on these issues that you're talking about with President Zelensky. How would you interpret that? What's your reaction to that?
Well, I don't think it was a perfect phone call for Ukraine, and I certainly don't think it was a perfect phone call for the United States either. We need to be supporting Ukraine in its path toward democratic development, in its anti-corruption work, not weaponizing that corruption that exists in Ukraine and creating disinformation around it in order to meet our own domestic political gains. It's certainly not the role that the United States has played in the past, and one I hope we don't play in the future.
Well, you know, and we sort of introduced this concept as we were coming to you, that now the EU ambassador, the U.S. EU ambassador, Gordon Sondland, is testifying. And he's, you know, we've got a look at his opening statement where he actually says that, you know, we thought it better to go through government channels, but we were directed to go through Rudy Giuliani. And he went on to say, we all agreed perhaps that was the best way to go. It wasn't until later that we thought perhaps there was an ulterior motive on Giuliani's part and his associates' part. Tell us what you, how do you analyze what's going on in with all these ambassadors and Trump appointees, not to mention the fired or recalled official U.S. ambassador to Ukraine?
Well, I think it's a very murky situation. I was in Ukraine during the presidential election, the Ukrainian presidential election this spring, covering it. And all the smearing of Ambassador Yovanovitch started just 10 days before the Ukrainian presidential election, the first round. And I thought to myself, this is a terrible time for people who are outside of U.S. politics to be undermining U.S. foreign policy in Ukraine. We need to be sending a signal of support, not one of confusion and this incongruity between official policy and what the White House and Trump's associates are saying and doing. And from the very beginning, it was clear that Mr. Giuliani and others surrounding President Trump were attempting to smear the ambassador, a career ambassador who served under Republican and Democratic administrations and is always pitch perfect in everything she says, her support for Ukraine, her support for democracy writ large. That's the sort of message that the United States needed to be sending. And now, unfortunately, as we know, Ambassador Yovanovitch was recalled ostensibly because of the work that she did in Ukraine and the strong support that she had in terms of delivering that U.S. stance, which we had taken for many, many years.
So let me talk to you, because this all basically comes down to the anti-corruption fight that the United States has taken, as you say, for many years to Ukraine and is trying to, you know, persuade Ukrainians that they need to get serious on this. As part of her opening statement, and Ambassador Yovanovitch testified in defiance of the ban by the administration. She went up to Capitol Hill, and part of what she said was, "I do not know Mr. Giuliani's motives for attacking me, but individuals who've been named in the press as contacts of Mr. Giuliani may well have believed that their personal financial ambitions were stymied by our anti-corruption policy in Ukraine." And we know since that several of these associates of Mr. Giuliani have been arrested and they are under investigation because of these allegations. Tell us what you know about the extent of that kind of corruption in Ukraine and where Ukraine is vulnerable in terms of corruption and how their prosecutors are working and what the U.S. effort has been to try to stop that.
Certainly. Well, since the Revolution of Dignity or the Euromaidan Revolution, which took place in 2013, 2014, Ukraine has made a lot of efforts to reform its judicial system, to reform its police system, to stop bribe taking. It's made more progress in the past 5 years than it has in the past 30 total. But that being said, there are still opportunities for individuals with ulterior motives to exploit that system. We saw this with Mr. Manafort. We see it with other individuals and political consultants who go not only to Ukraine, but other countries in the post-Soviet space in order to peddle these illicit deals. And certainly that is something that the United States government has worked against. And we have supported Ukraine in its anti-corruption efforts. I find it ironic that the folks who are seeking out these deals, and of course, Mr. Giuliani himself is one of the people who has done this sort of behavior. You can look up some reporting by Casey Michelle that is excellent on this topic. I find it ironic that he's attacking anti-corruption activists like Daria Kolenyuk from the Anti-Corruption Activism Center in Ukraine, who has put her personal safety on the line in order to encourage the Ukrainian government to prosecute these cases. These are the types of people that the U.S. government should be supporting, not attacking.
You are an expert on disinformation. When you look at this, where do you see the main tentacles of disinformation?
Well, I mean, I see five or four different conspiratorial narratives rolled into one here. We have this disinformation about Vice President Biden and the supposed ask he made of President Poroshenko to protect his son. Of course, this isn't true. He asked for a former corrupt prosecutor to be fired in order to release a loan guarantee, not to protect his son. Firing that prosecutor actually made his son more vulnerable to prosecution. We have this narrative that the DNC servers or Hillary Clinton's email servers are somehow located in Ukraine. We have a narrative that the Ukrainian government colluded with the Democrats in order to throw the election for Hillary Clinton. None of this is true. And all of this is being thrown into one disinformation narrative in order to confuse voters. And ultimately, as you were saying to Prime Minister Kasyanov in the earlier segment, the winner here is Russia, because it's undermining Ukraine's new democratic administration. It's undermining support for democracy in Ukraine, not only from the United States, but the international community, and putting at risk Ukraine's further Euro-Atlantic integration. And finally, it's saying to people around the world that U.S. democracy and U.S. support for democracy can be bought. And that's exactly what Russia wants. All of this murkiness just puts a big medal in President Putin's lap and undermines our support for democracy writ large around the world. And that's what makes me most upset about what we've learned over the past couple of weeks.
Yeah, and these are indeed fragile and troubling times. Nina Jankovits, thank you very much for joining me. Now, while President Trump fights off impeachment, his friend in Britain, Prime Minister Boris Johnson, is trying to bring on Brexit. Today, the UK and the EU announced a deal. But does that mean that this long, sorry saga is over? Far from it, because it still has to pass both European and UK parliaments, something it's failed to do in the past.
It hasn't always been an easy experience for the UK. It's been long, it's been painful, it's been divisive. And now is the moment for us as a country to come together. Now is the moment for our parliamentarians to come together and get this thing done.
Now, the sticking point for Brexit has always been that Britain's exit will mean reintroducing border posts on the frontier between Northern Ireland, which remains part of the UK, and the Republic of Ireland, which is in the EU. Today, the chief EU negotiator said peace in Ireland is his priority.
Let me say very frankly that for me, since day one, since 3 years, what really matters are the people. The people of Northern Ireland and Ireland. What really matters is peace.
The Good Friday Agreement of 1998 ended the 30-year sectarian conflict in which more than 3,500 people died. And that complex, painful period of history is why this is so complex and fragile. Jonathan Powell is Tony Blair's former chief of staff and chief government negotiator for that Good Friday Agreement, and he's joining me here in the studio. Welcome back to our program.
Thank you. Try
to make some sense of all of this. So, first and foremost, do you think that Boris Johnson has pulled off what Theresa May couldn't?
Well, it's sort of a rather extraordinary journey of negotiation where he has, in fact, adopted something Theresa May originally accepted, the original backstop, which meant that Northern Ireland remained in the customs union as single market. She went there to Brussels, sat with Juncker, about to negotiate it, and was humiliatingly called back by the DUP, who said, no, you're not going to agree to that. And she had to move off it. She said, in fact, no British Prime Minister could sign up for an agreement like that.
Can I play that soundbite?
Please.
I'm going to play it and then we're going to talk about it.
The draft legal text the Commission have published would, if implemented, undermine the UK common market and threaten constitutional integrity of the UK by creating a customs and regulatory border down the Irish Sea. And no UK Prime Minister could ever agree to it.
So I wanted to play it because you referred to it, but also who was there in the background as Foreign Secretary, one Boris Johnson, who was busy nodding that no British Prime Minister could agree to it. But now you say he is.
He has agreed to it. He is a man of no particular fixed principles, and he has no difficulty agreeing to something he's contradicted before. But it does create its own problems. The good news is by going into the single market and the customs union as originally proposed, we will avoid a hard border in between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland. That is good. That will help preserve the peace. Mm-hmm. The problem is someone's rights were always going to get trampled on this. There has to be a border somewhere because we're leaving. Can either between Ireland North and South or between the rest of the UK and Northern Ireland. What he's opted for, because that's what he could get from the EU, is a hard border between Northern Ireland and the rest of the UK. And that's a big problem for the unionists. The unionists believe we should be a united kingdom and they should be a part of it. They can't have a hard border.
And you know those people very well because, in fact, you negotiated with them. The unionists, this particular unionist party who form the alliance with Boris Johnson in Parliament, are actually really hard line. They didn't even vote for the peace agreement, did they?
They didn't even come to the Good Friday negotiations. In fact, the only time they came was to march with drums to protest against it. But they signed up later to it at St Andrews. They basically accepted it later, but they weren't there at the time. And they are hard line, but they are also unionists. And their rights have been trampled on by putting this hard border in.
OK, so let's read their statement. They say the government has departed from the principle that these arrangements must be subject to consent of both unionists and nationalists in Northern Ireland. This drives a coach and horses through the professed sanctity of the Belfast Agreement. I mean, they're setting themselves up not to vote for this when there's an emergency session. First time since 1982 in the Falklands War, yep, that there's an emergency session of the British Parliament on Saturday, on a Saturday, and it's this Saturday. Given the math, given what you know about all of this, given the DUP statement, given the fact that the Labour Party, the Scottish National Party, the Liberal Democratic Party and all the other parties say that they're not going to vote for it, what do you think is going to happen on Saturday?
It looks to me, but you can never be sure because so many surprising things are happening in British politics at the moment, they will not get it through. Without the DUP, that's them 10 down, they're going to get very few Labour rebels voting with them because of the antagonistic position that Boris Johnson has taken. They're going to have a number of the people he's thrown out of the Tory party not voting with them. He does not have the numbers to get that through at the moment on Saturday. And that then forces him towards the 31st of October and that date. So he's got a real problem in terms of that. And the DUP, I do understand their position. Not only are they putting a hard border in there, they're saying that they, the DUP, will not have a say in whether that stays the position for Britain forever. Mm-hmm. Because what's really happened here is this was called a backstop because it was an insurance policy, because we're going to have a different relationship once we've negotiated Britain's relationship with the EU. Right. But that's not going to happen now. This is not a backstop. This is what's going to happen from now on.
It's quite hard to take that, you know, I mean, Amber Rudd, for instance, has said, you know, she's one of the ones who left because of this hurtling towards a no deal. She has basically said that what Boris Johnson has done, and actually what Jacob Rees-Mogg also has said, which is, now I really trust in my bones. In fact, I'm going to play what he said, because he was the hardliner, yep, whose party and or whose sort of cabal, if I could say, torpedoed Theresa May. Look at what he says about this.
Now I know what is in the deal, my trust has been completely justified. It is a really exciting and positive deal. It removes the undemocratic backstop. It is a huge advance for the whole of the United Kingdom. It will ensure that we are one single customs territory.
Well, I mean, as you've said, it looks like actually it's more of a capitulation, more concession to Europe than Theresa May's did. And Amber Rudd, former Home Secretary, has said there's a, quote, whiff of sexism in how the Conservatives are backing Boris, you know, much more than they backed Theresa May. Do you agree?
I do, really, yes. I mean, if I was Theresa May, I would be really hopping mad at the moment. These rebels who stopped her getting the deal through, including Boris Johnson and Rees-Mogg, have now adopted a deal that's actually worse from the point of view of the unionists. And they're glorying in it while she was turned over by them. But she may have her last laugh, because if he can't get it through Parliament either, we're going to have this continuing saga going on and on.
So what does that look like, this continuing saga? Because as you just mentioned a couple of minutes ago, there's this deadline of the 31st. What does that mean now? Because they have a deal. Will the EU, even if the UK wants a delay, another extension, will the EU, you know, allow that if it can't get through Parliament?
I'm pretty sure the EU will allow it. They're trying to make this evening quite tough noises, saying this is your last chance, vote for it or there'll be no deal, because they want to try and help Boris Johnson get this through. They can't face the prospect of having to negotiate this all over again. Yeah. So they're pushing pretty hard. But they're stopping short of saying there'll be no extension. And if Boris Johnson is forced by the Benn Act, the legislation that's been passed, to go to Brussels and ask for an extension, they will give an extension. I think one way he could, of course, get this deal through Parliament would be to adopt this amendment that's been put on the table, which would require a confirmatory ballot, a second referendum. Mm-hmm. If he put that on the table, then he'd get the Labour Party votes and he might have the numbers to get through. Of course, he would then lose many of the hardliners on his own side. So even then, it would be dicey. But that might be one way forward, which would at least give the British people a say on this and draw a line once and for all.
And that would be another massive concession, wouldn't it? Because the last thing Boris Johnson and his kind of hardline group want is a second referendum.
It is, but on the other hand, he's made so many concessions now, including with the EU. One more concession, maybe his only way through, and he, as I say, is a very flexible man, so maybe that's what he'll go for.
And how will this be spun? Because one other thing people think is that there might be an election and that Boris Johnson will be able to say, look, I did it. I did it by the deadline. I said do or die. I said I wanted a deal. I did get a deal. I got a better deal than Theresa May. Will he be able to spin this like that and then win some kind of resounding election victory?
His dream scenario is that Parliament on Saturday votes for his deal. He gets it through. He goes to an election and he can say, I'm the guy who got Brexit. No one else could get it. I got it. That would give him a big victory because the votes on the left in this country are divided now, half and half, between the Liberals on 20% and Labour on 20%. He, without a Brexit party to his right, because that would collapse in those circumstances, would have a massive victory in 5 years in which to implement all of this. That's what he hopes for. At the moment, he doesn't have the numbers to do that. He's not going to get it through Parliament. And that means it's more likely we'd end up with a referendum first and election second. And that's a problem for him because he said he would die in a ditch if it wasn't done by the 31st.
So it's really interesting. You've said several times we might have a second referendum. I mean, this is what all the Remainers have wanted. This is what, you know, members of your own party, like Alistair Campbell, who was, you know, with you in Downing Street and key advisor to Prime Minister Blair. Blair himself, they want a second referendum. It's something that the current Labour leader has never been able to commit to.
He hasn't, but I think he's moving in that direction, and particularly this amendment that's on the table by two Labour MPs, which will enjoy a great deal of support. I can't be sure that it will get through, but I think it's increasingly going there. In fact, I remember my old boss, Tony Blair, saying to me, you know, what they'll do is they'll try everything else first, and only when everything else has failed will they end up with a referendum. But we're just approaching the point where everything else has failed.
Can I make you swerve from Brexit to what we're seeing in Syria? I mean, you were a chief advisor on all sorts of aspects to Prime Minister Blair, and there were lots of Middle East issues and all sorts of other issues during your time. And you were very close allies of the United States at that time, of course. How do you read what the US is doing with its allies in Syria, the Kurds, abandoning them, basically green-lighting the Erdogan invasion or whatever, intervention into northern Syria?
It's tragic. I think it's absolutely tragic. Ambassador Jim Jeffrey of the US had negotiated a very good deal with the Turks about what would happen with joint patrols by the US and the Turks. All of that was ready to play out. It was all killed by one phone call in the middle of the night. It turned the whole thing on its head. And now you have President Erdogan and his forces going into this area and death and destruction going with it. And it won't be a short-term thing because once they're in place, there'll be targets for these guerrillas and these guerrillas will be attacking them. So it's not as if this drew a line under the thing and settled it. I fear this just means the suffering in Syria goes on and on. And all because of a phone call in the middle of the night. It seems a very strange way to do foreign policy.
They're about to talk, Vice President Pence and Secretary of State Pompeo, after their meetings with Erdogan. Let's take a listen.
Today, the United States and Turkey have agreed to a ceasefire in Syria. The Turkish side will pause Operation Peace Spring in order to allow for the withdrawal of YPG forces from the safe zone for 120 hours.
What do you make of that, and what will be the bigger outcome?
Well, it sounds like very good news for President Erdogan. What the Americans have actually done is facilitated the surrender of their allies, the Kurds, and they have to run, turn tail, and leave their territory. It does sound pretty one-sided agreements, and if I were the Kurds, I'd be even more upset about this than what's happened to them so far. They're not even allowed to carry on fighting.
Oh, it really beggars belief, this. And our, you know, first guest, former Russian Prime Minister, was saying that this, all of this, is a gift to President Putin. And also the House Speaker Nancy Pelosi has said about President Trump that all roads seem to lead to Putin. Is this now sort of Putin in charge of that critical area, and not to mention Assad back in charge of his whole country?
As former Prime Minister Kasanov was saying, I think this is very good news for Putin, but I think it's fairly short-term good news. It's good news for him and his profile rather than for Russia. Russia does not have the ability to be a superpower in the Middle East. In the end, there will be an American leader who reasserts American leadership in the region. It's just a question of how long we have to wait for that. At the moment, I fear that's what we have lost. And the real impact of this is no ally can rely on the United States in these circumstances. So it's a loss for the United States, a loss for the world, rather than a long-term gain for Russia.
Jonathan Powell, thank you so much indeed. Well, all of this week, on slightly better news, the Duke and Duchess of Cambridge are in Pakistan. As part of an official tour of that country, the royal couple have been wowing crowds with their traditional dress as they attend receptions and visit hospitals and schools to highlight the importance of education, especially for young girls. Pakistan is making progress on education, but it's a country facing serious challenges, and our next guest knows that all too well. Gulala Ismail has been an advocate for human rights since she was 16 years old. For many years now, she's been speaking out against abuses, especially towards women and girls. Last year, she began to advocate for victims of alleged sexual abuse by the country's army, and for that, she's paid a heavy price. As she explained to our Michelle Martin, she felt she had to flee her homeland.
Gulala Ismail, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Pleasure.
You've said a couple of times that in interviews that you didn't want to leave Pakistan. I mean, that was not your goal. That was not your intention. I mean, one of the reasons that many people became concerned is that a couple of months ago, you disappeared and no one knew where you were. And, you know, here you are in New York. You've asked for political asylum. What happened that caused you to feel you had to leave?
So I had been working on human rights for past 17 years. I started with working on young women's rights, championing the cause for girls' education, political participation of young women. I was training young women to take active part in elections. I was training young women to be election monitors. And I'm so proud to say that in 2015, when local elections were happening, 10 young women who were trained by our organization, they were running for public offices. So that was the kind of work that I was doing. In 2009, I think the world will remember that how militancy became a big phenomenon, religious extremism became a big phenomenon in Pakistan, and some areas of Pakistan were taken in control by Taliban, and they were recruiting young people in militant organizations. That was the point in my life when I decided that, you know, I need to work with young people to prevent them from being recruitment in militant organizations. Young people do not deserve to be suicide bombers. Young people do not deserve to be militants. They deserve to have a happy life. They deserve. So we started a network, Youth Peace Network. And
so you were expanding your work beyond your specific and original focus on young women and girls. Did you feel at the time safe, though, even though what you were doing was not universally appreciated or applauded or even taken seriously?
When we were working, we were having an impact, but most of the people in the community, they thought, oh, they are just young women. They are just these crazy young women who are westernized and who want to bring in Western ideology. So initially, we were always safe because as young women, we thought we will never be targeted. But it changed in 2013 when for the first time our house was attacked by unknown gunmen. They came at our door, knocking at our door, threatening my family that if we didn't stop working, if we didn't stop westernizing our society, then we shall remain, you know, ready for consequences. That was the time that I knew that, oh, our work is actually having a huge impact on the society, and that is why some people are feeling so threatened that they want to silence us at any cost.
Did you have a sense at the time of who was opposing you?
The attacks were always by unknown. You know, no one ever took responsibility. So it was really difficult to figure out that who are the people who are attacking us? Who are the people that do not like our work? But then we also come from a country where when state is against you, especially when the security agencies of the country do not like your work, then you are often attacked through unknown people. So we knew that when unknown people attack you without anyone taking responsibility for it, then the chances are high that the state security agencies are behind the attack.
What exactly did they think you were doing that they wanted you to stop?
In my cases, it started with a deadly blasphemy campaign online. Mm-hmm. I was accused of blasphemy for being a woman rights activist.
Which is a crime in Pakistan, right? Blasphemy is a crime.
Blasphemy is a crime, and you can be punished with death sentence. And not only that, the courts can give you death sentence, but also once you are accused of blasphemy, people can kill you in mob lynching. You know, one day I woke up, I was checking my social media, and I saw a video out there. There was a young man who had said that my work on women's rights is irreligious, immoral, anti-Islam, and that I am a tumor to the society. I need to be finished. He threatened me that he will kill me, and he also asked other people to come and kill me. So, and that can campaign became viral on the internet. For 3 months, there was so much hate against me on the internet. People were inciting violence against me. People would give me death threats. Some would give me rape threats. Some would give me mob lynching threats. And then protests started against me in my own city. Yeah, people would just come up and, you know, ask to ban me or to, you know, do something against me because I'm anti-Islam, anti-culture, and anti-state.
How did you deal with that?
At that time, you know, I wanted to stand on my ground. So I decided that I will use state to get protection of myself. So I went to police, and also, you know, at that time, police took my complaint seriously. The video was taken off the internet because the video was very dangerous. And a young man who was leading the campaign, his bail was cancelled, and he was sent to jail for around one week. So that kind of, you know, set a precedent in the country that, no, you cannot threaten women when they speak out for themselves, when they speak out for their rights. And if you do, then there will be consequences to it.
Having prevailed in that case, what made you feel you had to leave now?
At that time, a movement emerged in our region. It was a coincidence that right at that time, a movement emerged against the state-enforced terrorism. It is known as Pashtun Tahfiz Movement. The movement was sparked by extrajudicial killing of a young man. He was labeled as terrorist by police, and he was killed in a fake police encounter. Because of that incident, countrywide protests sparked, and those protests, they led into a long march. Thousands of people, they came to Islamabad. Most of them were young people from the tribal areas of Pakistan. Tribal areas are the areas of Pakistan which had remained a hub of terrorism for more than 2 decades. The state of Pakistan has been using tribal areas to harbor its proxies and use those Taliban militant organizations as proxies in Kashmir and Afghanistan. And then after 9/11, when there was a lot of international pressure on Pakistan to become a partner on war against terrorism, and Pakistan was facing international pressure, mm-hmm. so military counterterrorism operations were done in these tribal areas. However, what might the world not know is that most of the leaders of the terrorist organizations, they were given safe exit already. And in the counterterrorism operations, like, you know, most of the people there, who were targeted were common, innocent people. Their homes were destroyed. Millions of people got displaced.
Your allegation is what? That they are using the tribal areas as a cover for their failure to control these terrorist groups? So what is your theory of the case of the Pakistani security forces?
Our theory is that Pakistan military has been facilitating terrorist organizations. They had been promoting and protecting terrorist organizations so that they can be used. They have not just turned blind eye. They are partner in the crime. And the most important, as part of Pashtun Tahfiz movement, the most important thing for us is that the military shall be held accountable for the human rights abuses that have been committed in the Pashtun regions. You know, the tribal regions of Pakistan, they were kept as a black hole. There was Pakistan constitution did not apply over there. Pakistani laws did not apply over there. There was a different kind of, they were ruled, they were governed by different kind of laws. People did not have access to free and fair trial. Media was not allowed. Civil society was not allowed to monitor the conflict. Mm-hmm. So for a long time, for decades, the world was not knowing that what is actually happening in the tribal areas. But then after this movement emerged, thousands of people came together and they are asking for justice. Thousands of people are asking for putting an end to war economy. The basic problem in the whole, you know, in Pakistan is that our economy is war economy. It is fueled by war. We are depending on aid from the U.S. In the counterterrorism operations. And we will keep on receiving aid on counterterrorism operation only if there is a problem of terrorism.
So your argument is that the people in this area have essentially been held hostage, yeah, both by Pakistani military forces, security forces, and also by terrorists, and that they're basically caught in the middle. Yeah. And your argument is that you have now been targeted because you're speaking up for them.
Yes.
You've been working on this for so long, for like 17 years, and all this time, I mean, you've certainly left the country to meet with other activists and significant figures around the world. But this is the first time you felt that you had to flee for your life. Yeah. Why is that?
It was November 2018 when the intelligence agencies of Pakistan, they approached me. They called me for a meeting. They said that, you know, we want to settle the matter with you. So we want to have a meeting with you. They called me to their district headquarters. And when I went there...
You actually did go.
I actually did go. My father did not want me to go, but I wanted to go and see what's happening. And my father was afraid that they would just take me from there and they can make me a missing person. So he went with me there. And when we went to the meeting, I did ask them, what is your problem? Like, there thousands of people are coming and participating in the protest. I am not the only one, but why you are targeting me? And they told me, because you are an internationally recognized human rights activist. When you are part of the movement is seen as a credible movement internationally by the international community. And that is why we do not want you to be part of the movement.
And what did they say? I mean, did they specifically tell you to stop talking? Like, what did they make demands of you?
Or oh, yeah. They told my father that if you do not make sure that she's silent and she does not support the movement onwards, we are going to kill her.
Then they told it. You to your face?
They told it on the face of my father mm-hmm. that we will kill her if she does not stop supporting the movement, if you do not control her, if she is not silenced onward, we will kill her. And it's just so easy for her to, you know, to promote the narrative that she has been killed either by Afghanistan or by the movement itself, because movements need martyrs and she will become the first martyr of the movement. And they said it on the face of my father mm-hmm. that we will kill her. And what next?
To the degree that you can, without compromising the safety of others, how did you get out?
My pictures were pasted on all borders of Pakistan under the most wanted list. So my pictures were everywhere. I heard from different friends that they have deployed, Pakistan security forces have deployed special people on the borders who were looking for me so that I cannot leave Pakistan. However, I had a small security net. My friends went out and they went to all borders of Pakistan. They did a research on every possible means, on every possible safest means to get out of Pakistan. They found a way for me.
What about here? I mean, you're in New York at the moment. You do have family here. Do you feel safe here? I mean, there's a large Pakistani community here. I mean, do you feel that the reach of the security forces extends this far? Or do you feel that the laws of the United States is sufficient?
I came to the U.S. with the vision of getting protection. The protection which I could not get in my own country, the country where I always wanted to live, the country which I never wanted to leave. But I was made feel so unsafe that I couldn't live there anymore. I would not say that I left Pakistan. I was forced to leave Pakistan. That was not my choice. That was the state compelled me to leave the country. Now I am here seeking protection, and I hope that this is a free society. I believe that the state here will protect me. However, safety, feeling safe is not a magic bullet. And a few days ago, there was a protest in front of United Nations. Some of my friends were from the movement. They were holding a protest when Prime Minister of Pakistan, Imran Khan, was speaking in United Nations. On that day, hundreds of people were protesting in front of UN because of the Kashmir issue. And many of the protesters were also pro-Pakistani, pro-ISI people who were there in the protest. Our protest, which was against state-enforced terrorism in Pakistan and for peace in Pakistan, we were a small group of 25 people. And when these pro-ISI Pakistani people came to know that I was also there in the protest, hundreds of them came down to our protest and they started shouting at me that I'm a traitor, that I'm a traitor. And, you know, they were giving very vulgar signs as if they were, you know, harassing me and giving me rape threats. So their body language was very vulgar.
That had to have been frightening.
You know, I felt so sad when I looked at them because I was like, look, here I am, someone who just left everything in a struggle of survival, who left her family, who left her country and came here so that she can survive, she can speak out. And we are just a small group of 25 people, but you will not even let me speak here. Mm-hmm. Though if I speak about, you know, I don't know how big of impact I can have if I speak in front of UN in a small protest. Like, it was a small voice, but they were not even tolerant to our small group of people, to our voice.
What do you hope to gain by speaking out here?
I am hoping that by being here, I am defying the Pakistan state's aim of silencing me. My purpose of being here is to keep on raising voice about the human rights abuses that have been committed in the Pashtun region by Pakistan military. By being speaking out, I am hoping that I will be able to get justice for thousands of people who are victim of enforced disappearances, who are victim of extrajudicial killing. By coming here and by speaking out, I hope to achieve peace for my people. I hope to achieve peace in Pakistan. And I also, you know, in the past 4 months, I have experienced that when you are a woman peace builder and when you are at risk by the state, by your own state, there is so little support for you out there. I had my sister in the U.S., and she was speaking out and she was making sure that my case is not forgotten, that people aren't listening. People are aware that there is a peace activist who is in danger, whose life is in danger, and she needs to be rescued. But I am just one lucky person who had a sister and who had international support of international community, some peace organizations, international organizations who kept on raising voice for me. Not every woman peace builder, not every human rights defender is that lucky. And by coming here, I want to become voice of those human rights defenders whose life is at risk in their own countries and there is no one to speak out for them.
I understand that as a citizen of Pakistan that you don't feel called to criticize the policies of the United States. But I do want to ask if you are concerned about the current political environment in the United States, which has become, I don't know whether the word is hostile. In some quarters, it is more hostile to people seeking political asylum. And does that concern you?
I know that the world is becoming unfriendly to migration. Now, countries do not want people from other countries, even when they are at risk, even when their life is at risk, they don't, you know, they are not welcomed. So it makes you feel like a stateless person. It makes you feel as if, you know, if you are being persecuted by your own country, then you have nowhere to go. So you remain in a state of limbo, and it is a very painful situation when you when you're not sure where to look forward, you know, to whom you can look forward yeah. To whom you can look up to for protection. So it is, it's a difficult situation.
So before we let you go, though, is there anything giving you hope right now?
When I look at the young people in my country and I look at the collective power of young people, they are coming together for peace. I have never seen something that beautiful. When I would be standing back home and I would be standing in a protest and there would be 50,000 people, 70,000 people together in one place asking for peace. That gives me hope. I think the collective power of young people to ask for peace is the most powerful thing in the world.
Gulalay Ismail, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Indeed, young people today have the hopes of the world on their shoulders across so many different fronts. But that is it for now. Remember, you can listen to our podcast, see us online at amanpour.com, and follow me on Instagram and Twitter. Thank you for watching, and goodbye from London.
When you work next level. And when you play next level. And when it's time to sleep, Sleep Number smart beds are designed to embrace your uniqueness, providing you with high-quality sleep every night. Sleep next level. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, the Queen Sleep Number C4 smart bed is only $1,599. Save $300 for a limited time, only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com. Prices higher in Alaska and Hawaii. Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number smart bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.